Okay. Looks like most people can hear me. We're in Matthew chapter 8. But I kind of like, Matthew chapter 8 starts off, when he had come down from the mountain, great multitudes followed him. So I kind of like the way Joel did the class Sunday morning. He started off with a pop quiz. So what was Jesus doing on the mount that he came down from? And preaching, okay? And so then the next question, and I'm not going to tell you what kind of grade I made on Joel's pop quiz, because I was going to try to refresh our memory then. When short phrases and short answers, what was some of the things that Jesus taught on the mountain? Of course, it's only, you know, three chapters worth of information here, but the Sermon on the Mount, but just kind of pop quiz. Somebody want to take a shot at a few things? Okay.
All about the heart. So the heart is the foundation of your behavior.
Okay. Anybody else want to throw some things out there? If not, well, I've got a list. Just kind of, it's random. I mean, it's not complete, but just to review some of the things that were talked about in chapter 5, 6, and 7. Chapter 5, how to be blessed, be salt and light, be righteous, keep your heart pure, marriage is sacred and binding, go the second mile, love your enemies. Chapter 6, take heed that you do your charitable deeds before men. In this manner, therefore, pray. Do not lay for yourselves treasures on earth. The lamp of the body is the eye. No one can serve two masters. Therefore, I say to you, do not worry about your life. Chapter 7, judge not hypocritically. Ask, seek, knock. Remember the increase there that's taught. Enter by the narrow gate. Beware of false prophets. So this is kind of a summary, maybe a real great summary, but a summary of the things that Jesus taught. So he says at the end of that, end of chapter 7, he says, therefore, whoever hears these sayings of mine and does them, I will liken him to a wise man. So some of these things that we need to listen to Jesus about, to learn about, not only to hear them and to understand them, but to do them if we want to be wise in God's eyes. And then he says, and so it was, when Jesus had ended these sayings, that the people were astonished at his teaching, for he taught them as one having authority and not as the scribe. Now, the people were astonished. Later on, this is going to help Jesus. In Luke 19, he was teaching daily in the temple, but the chief priests, the scribes, and the leaders of the people sought to destroy him and were unable to do anything, for the people were very attentive to his hearing, to hearing him. And as was mentioned just this Sunday morning, this past Sunday morning, this verse was talked about, quoted. It says, for the word of God is living and powerful and sharper than any two-edged sword, piercing even the division of soul and spirit and joints and marrow, and a discerner of the thoughts and intents of the heart. So the word needs to work on our heart. And I believe that it seems like that these people who heard and who listened seem to have been cut to the heart, just as those in like Acts chapter 2 and so many other places. They were listening and they were astonished at his teaching. So Matthew 8 is what we're studying tonight. That was just a little review there. So he came down from the mountain. and great multitudes followed him. Remember Matthew 5:1, just what we just talked about, seeing the multitude, he went up on the mountain, and when he was seated, he taught them. So now he comes down from the mountain to confirm the word with miracles. That's what we're going to see in chapter 8. So some may have been asking, you know, who are you? You know, who is this teacher? And so true miracles will then confirm who he is as well as the absolute truth of his teaching. The miracles that we're going to read about in chapter 8 of Matthew and other places, they're immediate. They involve control of nature, unexplainable, visible to all. That is, they're done in public. Jesus is God with us. And I was thinking, you know, these miracles are pretty fascinating, but I think if we compare the miracles in this chapter to the other miracles that God has done, such as the creation of all things, creation of the heavens, the earth, I think then it seems that these miracles might be quite small in comparison, even though they are tremendously amazing. So also the Creator's demonstrating his heart by battling the diseases of the devil. Again, they're unexplainable. They're like the immediate cure of leprosy, curing a person from a distance. So Christ's miracles are so obvious, devoid of dishonesty, that not even his enemies could deny them. Later in John 11, it says, the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered a council and said, what shall we do? For this man works many signs. If we let him alone like this, everyone will believe in him. And the Romans will come and take away both our place and nation. And then, of course, you know, Jesus passed on the miracles to the apostles, and they had the same reaction. They couldn't deny the miracles of the apostles in Acts 4:16, saying, what shall we do with these men? For indeed, that a notable miracle has been done through them is evident to all who dwell in Jerusalem, and we cannot deny it. So not only did the rulers have problems criticizing Jesus' teaching, but they could not deny his miracles as well. So this chapter is a continuation of Jesus' work as described in Matthew 4:23 when he says, Jesus went about all Galilee, teaching in the synagogues, preaching the gospel of the kingdom, and healing all kinds of sickness and all kinds of disease among the people. And this we'll see continues on in Matthew 9. John 4:48 says, unless you people see signs and wonders, you will by no means believe. Okay. Any questions or comments so far? Okay.
That's all I want to go. This is God in the flesh that's come. And you talked about, you know, through Christ, we understand that everything that was created through him. So he had a direct working in everything that we see, feel, touch, and enjoy in this world. Yet he took the time for individuals when he was here. And I think that should tell us just how much the God who created an expanse we cannot comprehend. Even today, with all of our telescopes in space, we still can't really comprehend what it is that he's created. Yet he's still mindful of each and every one of us. Our value to him, I think sometimes we get depressed, we don't look at our own value, understand our value to him. Sometimes I think we undersell how valuable we are, how much he wants us to obey and to be with him, and hopefully that spurs us to obey him, not take that in a prideful manner by any means, because that's going to separate us from him. But the fact that what he does here with this leper that comes to him, with a centurion, I think it's a centurion, anyway, yeah. Roman yeah. soldier that comes to him that had command over others. And then the mother, Peter's mother.
Yep.
You know, these are very personal, very individual things for a being that's over it all. It'd be like going to
if there was a king of the world, not to your mayor, not to your governor, not to your president, but someone like that, and expect them to be mindful of just a minor thing like your fever, you're lying in bed. They would care, a man would care less.
Yeah.
The love there is neat.
I think
it's perfect for what I was going to present next. No, good. I like comments. I like to hear things. Sometimes I try to write notes, you know, for next time. Is there anybody? Did I see another hand somewhere? Okay.
At this point, Jesus coming down from the mountain, he, if I'm not mistaken, this is, he hadn't fed them, like he hadn't given them anything but the words of life.
Yeah.
And large crowds were following him from that. He didn't give them easy instructions. He taught some hard things, but they weren't hard for the sake of being hard preaching. Mm-hmm. It was very valuable to them and very relevant to them, and they wanted more of it.
You know, and that's kind of what I was, probably should have elaborated more when I was talking about the Word of God and what it does, you know, how it helps us and it cuts to our heart and, you know, and looks into the intent of the heart and all this. These people must be, you know, seeing that and absorbing it, like you're saying, and really seeing this is relevant to me, you know, and helpful. Why else would they be astonished? I mean, it's just what he was saying. That's the only thing there at that point. There's nothing else to draw them, okay?
How deeply the people needed something.
Yeah.
How deeply they needed to have hope from their current situation.
And after the sermon Sunday morning.
It wasn't a sermon. It was a kind of singing sermon or whatever.
You saw how some of them that truly believed it with their heart. Mm-hmm. You know, there's some that heard them, but they denied them. There were some that just didn't even want to hear. Yeah. So even today, there's varying levels of how people, one, respond, and two, are willing to listen. Mm-hmm. Because there's people that you may say, but they don't really believe it.
Yeah.
The ones that really believed it throughout the New Testament, you see how they related to Christ.
Yeah, and he says, you know, not only hear, but do.
That says there are three things that humans need. Someone to love, something to do, and something to hope for. Bad things were happening. This is something to hope for.
Okay.
These comments are leading right into very well, I think, what I was going to do next, Matthew 8:1-4. Let's just look at that. So again, when he comes down from the mountain, verse 1, multitude follow him. And behold, a leper came and worshipped him, saying, Lord, if you're willing, can you make me clean? And Jesus put his hand and touched him, saying, I am willing, be cleansed. And immediately his leprosy was cleansed. And Jesus said to him, see that you tell no one. But go your way and show yourself to the priests and offer a gift that Moses commanded as a testimony to them. So just, I think, what everybody's been saying, Lord, if you're willing, you could make me clean. I know the story is a man with leprosy, but this was a picture that I came up with. And I mean, I can't dwell on that picture too long, or I'd zoom in if I knew how to do that, but I don't. But if you'd look closely and just look for a while at these women that have leprosy, I mean, as has been pointed out, people are in need. I don't know if you could tell, but this woman doesn't have any hands. Who knows what else would be revealed, but this is the condition of the lepers, you know, at this time. And Luke, the physician, the parallel account in Luke 5 says this man was full of leprosy, indicating an advanced case. So the man says, if you're willing, and if I understand it right, this is an expression of doubt, but not about Christ's strength. I don't think at all this is a lack of faith or anything, but it's about his sympathy. It says, are you willing to heal a person like me? You know? It's almost like this woman here is saying that. Are you willing to be around me, to help me, to heal me? And Jesus will say, I'm willing, be clean, be cleansed. And immediately his leprosy was cleansed. So I think it just expresses what already has been expressed. This is what Jesus is doing. Any comments, questions? All right.
All about him attitude, right?
Oh,
I think
yeah.
when we're praying, sometimes we can get the attitude of, well, can you do this, and can you do this, and can you do this, and you can you help me with this, you know? And he didn't say, Lord, make me clean. Like, the fact that he said the terms, Lord, if you are willing, that implies that he's not trying to gain control. He's letting the Lord decide. And I think that is an attitude that we can always strive to be better at.
He recognizes who he is. And then it's, if you will, in other words, I will be done. His approach seems to be incredibly humble for someone who is, I'm sure, in intense pain looking at that person.
Yeah.
And been that way for a long time,
yeah.
In all likelihood.
So Jesus then says, see that you tell no one, but go your way. So Jesus encouraged the man to follow the law, but to tell no one. So in the parallel account, however, the report went around about him, concerning him, all the more. Great multitudes came together to hear him, and he healed by him of their infirmities. He also himself often withdrew into the wilderness and prayed. So now he's actually done some things that, you know, another reason people are coming to him. So it's the miracles and the teaching. Okay, so let's see here. Matthew 5 through 13 begins when Jesus had entered Capernaum. So he returned to Capernaum, which was introduced earlier as his home after returning to Galilee. So I'm not going to read all of 5 through 13, but this is begins the story about the centurion. In verse 5, it continues, a centurion came to him, pleading with him, saying, Lord, my servant is lying at home, paralyzed, dreadfully tormented. And he goes on and says, Jesus said to him, I will come and heal him. But the centurion answered, said, Lord, I am not worthy that you should come under my roof, but only speak a word and my servant will be healed. So once again, we're seeing somebody showing the humility that, you know, I'm not worthy. You know, you're God with us, and I'm not worthy that you should come under my roof. So the centurion had apparently heard about Jesus, maybe from the Jews, maybe from the Mount. I don't know. The centurion is coming to Jesus with belief. This is directly stated in Matthew 18:8-10, where Jesus says, I have not found such great faith. And then also in Matthew 8:13, Jesus says, as you have believed, so let it be done for you. The centurion not only has faith, but he acts on it with humility and compassion for a subordinate. I realize this is this servant that he's talking about. You know, he's a centurion. He's over 100 people. He's a person in authority. And, you know, he could just, oh, this is a servant? Who cares, you know? But he's not that way. He's my servant needs healing. And so Jesus says, you know, many will come from the east and west, sit down with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven, but the son of the kingdom the sons of the kingdom will be cast out into outer darkness. There will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Jews and Gentiles are familiar with God, and his true prophets are taught that a Messiah would come. Many recognize, and this is somebody already pointed out, many will recognize and accept Jesus as the true Messiah that's prophesied about. But the Jews especially, the sons of the kingdom, all should recognize and respond to the Messiah. But instead, many rejected him. And many Gentiles, those coming from the east and west, would recognize him as a true Messiah and will be in the kingdom of God. So, what Jesus is saying there. So the centurion, I think, gives us insight in what a good and honest heart is. He is fertile ground, ready to take in the seed, accept it to grow and to produce fruit. He recognizes authority. The centurion has authority over 100 men, and so he recognizes Jesus as God, who has power over all mankind. Okay.
I'm under authority myself.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. So he's over people, and he's got people over him. And I think almost all of us are in that same situation. You know, you're in, there's some that may be independently without a boss, but most of us then have to answer to somebody somewhere. And ultimately, we need to all answer to God. But in our jobs, we also have to answer to somebody. He probably then has a degree of discipline in his life if he's risen to this position. Discipline is self-denial is one of those things we need to add to our faith, virtue, knowledge, self-denial. And he's able to discern between truth and error. He took on all the information, and he truly found the Son of God. Sometimes we're too quickly to say, I don't know. But it takes effort to know right from wrong. 2 Peter 1:5 says, give all diligence to add to your faith virtue, to virtue knowledge. So give all diligence to add that to our life. Later, a centurion would be convinced at Jesus' crucifixion, truly this man was the Son of God. And then later still, it would be a centurion, Cornelius, who would be the first Gentile convert to the new covenant. So we need to prepare our hearts to accept Jesus. Proverbs 29:23 tells us, a man's pride will bring him low, but the humble in spirit will retain honor. Proverbs 28:14, happy is the man who is always reverent, but he who hardens his heart will fall into calamity. Okay.
Station in life is one that would usually not be given to listen to others and would be more used to be giving orders. And I think that shows the people that the world would look at and say, well, they're going to be the least willing to listen. He was actually one that you wouldn't have thought would be willing to listen. Mm-hmm. He would be used to telling people what to do himself.
Yeah. Don't tell me what to do. I tell people what to do.
He had enough humility to know that his soul needed something.
Yeah, this is the next thing I was going to point out. He says, I'm a man under authority. I tell people to go, come, and do. You know, that's what he says. So I thought, does Jesus think of some things that Jesus says, go, come, and do? What about go? Go into all the world and teach, okay? Come unto me, hear and do, okay? Right, yeah, he said that right there. So he recognizes Jesus as a man of authority. They both do the same thing, you know, in that sense, obviously Jesus with more authority. But he marvels at the centurion's faith. Jesus marvels. He admires it. in most cases, the ones are the ones marveling are the people marveling at Jesus. But in this case, it was Jesus marveling at the centurion because of his faith. But there's other cases where Jesus is marveling because of unbelief. You know, we see, you know, marveling at their unbelief. And then there's a situation where the father had a child and a mute spirit and asked Jesus, but if you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us. And then later on he says, Lord, I believe, help me in my unbelief. So there's different levels of faith. But this is what Jesus is, well, we'll see this as we go through. This is what Jesus is focusing on, the faith. That's what he's marveling at here, his faith. And in other cases, the lack of faith are those that lack faith but want to increase their faith. So once again, the purpose of the miracles. Truly, Jesus did many other signs that are not in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book, but these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name. Once again, too, I mentioned it already that the sons of the kingdom will be cast out. And I wasn't going to, I guess I could spend some time with this, but I think it was mentioned last week, you know, who are the sons of, you know, who we emulate and who we follow, and that's who we're the sons of. And I think in this case he was talking about the sons of the kingdom are descendants of Abraham, but the ones who don't follow Jesus. Just to summarize it. Any comments, questions? Okay.
Within a handful of words, he uses this idea of kingdom in two different ways. And we need to be careful when we come across kingdom that we don't force a certain interpretation on it, on what it means. He talks about people coming from east and west to come into the kingdom of heaven. Well, okay, that's those who submit themselves to God's reign, and they're united with him in fellowship where he is in heaven, and his reign is in heaven. But then you have the sons of the kingdom. Well, normally we would think sons of the kingdom are the same people,
but not here. Not here, right.
Very clearly, they are the ones who should have been in the kingdom, but were not.
Yeah. They were in the physical kingdom that and needed to be in the new kingdom, I guess you'd say, the I don't know how to say that correctly, but any other? Okay, and so then at the end of this, the servant was healed that same hour. So this was a miracle, you know, instant, and it was from a distance. The next one is about verses, I won't read them all, but 14 and 15. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Parallel account. He says, the centurion figured out that he had been healed at that very hour when he asked when the servant was. He asked the people from his house when the servant was healed. Okay. I may be mixing this with another. Not a miracle, but
okay.
Am I thinking of the father whose the ruler whose daughter was sick because he went and when he came back the servants told him they coordinated on the time figured out it was that time.
Okay.
The centurion was sending messengers in Luke's account.
Yeah.
He never went and talked to Jesus by as far as I can tell.
Well, I was gonna maybe bring that up. It looks like I think. Well, let me see. I'd have to look at my notes how that plays out. You gotta, you know.
The thing is, and someone says something versus their message was sent.
Yeah.
Is used interchangeably, it seems.
Yeah. Yeah. I was thinking about maybe throwing my two cents worth out how that coordinates there, but anyway, yeah. there was some inner people in between, I guess you'd say, in that, if you look at the parallel account. Anything else? Okay. The next verses are about the healing of Peter's wife. And I was just going to make the point on this. It's just amazing. Who does some say there is no pope, but who's that claim there is such thing as a pope? Who was the first pope, most people say? Peter, okay? And pope can't be married, so I don't know. I just kind of point out some of these things. I did it in, some of the previous chapters. There's so many difficulties, when you look at the Bible with some of the teachings that are so prevalent and believed, that and there's so much explaining away that has to be done to try to, how did that happen, So it's kind of interesting. I have seen where some of these things have been pointed out to some that have been told that their whole lives, and they're all of a sudden going like, wow, I didn't realize the Bible said that. And all of a sudden, maybe they become open to, what else does the Bible say, that. So might be something to open a door, maybe.
Case, he has his mother-in-law who is sick and looks to be there at his house, where he's, family would be providing care for her. So, yeah. I mean, he didn't just have a wife, he had a whole family he was responsible for. It's amazing he could do more than he did.
Yeah. Okay, and then the next verses, we'll just kind of summarize them real quickly, 16 and 17, just wanted to use the point there that it's prophesied. What Jesus is going to do has been prophesied so long ago, and it's coming. It's all coming true, which is something just totally amazing in itself and could be a whole topic. Okay, the next section, 18 through 22, some more teachings of Jesus. Just kind of quickly look at, a scribe comes to Jesus and says to him, I'll follow you wherever you go. And Jesus said, foxes have holes and birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. So it seems to me maybe that the miracles created enthusiasts who need to learn that there's some difficulties connected with the discipleship before they start on their journey. Somebody said, that's just a quote from somebody that seems to me just to maybe explain all this. So there's some enthusiasm here, I'll follow you anywhere you go. And so Jesus starts to explain, there's some things that might happen, as you follow me. It seems like maybe there's a purposeful sequence here. First, the teaching on the mount, then the miracles to confirm the word, and this could instill enthusiasm, excitement in the disciples, then teaching again to the followers that all their earthly troubles won't end if you follow me. And I think this was pointed out in the Sunday morning sermon, that there's things that we deal with, and we need Jesus. And this is followed by what's going to happen next. Those that are following him are going to have a storm that they're going to deal with on the sea. So he says it here that there's issues that come up, and sure enough, they're in a boat and issues will come up. So Jesus knows the hearts of the individuals and reminds him that following may lead to earthly difficulties. Therefore, if the teacher has earthly difficulties, following him may lead to your own. Make sure you know what you're following. Remember, the goal is heaven, not earthly. For you know the grace of Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sakes he became poor, that through his poverty you might become rich. And, of course, that's talking about rich spiritually, not physically. And we, Jesus was rich. He was in heaven. He became poor. He came to earth that through his poverty we might go to heaven as well.
This is something I've run into when I was working up in Dallas with some coworkers, but they were very much being taught the health and wealth gospel. Mm-hmm. What did Jesus, the commander of it all, experience and enjoy on this earth? It was not health, it was not fame, and it certainly wasn't a lot of wealth and command. Mm-hmm. So I think that's another area we need to be careful when we hear that. Maybe the simple thing to ask, because I struggled with how to deal with that at the time, but it's kind of hitting me now. Are you sure about that? Because what kind of life did Christ have, the one who deserved it all when he got here and was over it all? It wasn't health, it wasn't wealth, it wasn't pride, it wasn't any of that. And he's the example, is he not, that we're supposed to be following. So what does that tell us? We're not promised any of those things. They may happen. Yeah. We see Christians who were wealthy at that time or who were in power, but it wasn't many, or even told the whole eye of the needle thing, whatever that means.
Yeah.
It does mean for sure it's hard and there won't be many that have those type of physical blessings in this world. Our example never had those things, and we shouldn't expect anything. I don't think any different. If someone tells us something different, that should be us testing the spirit of, I don't think this spirit that someone's trying to tell me is right. Accurate. Yeah. Dig deeper.
Yeah. I think you see that throughout the Bible. And, real quickly, I was going to do some more, but I don't know. But anyway, this one's interesting. So there's another disciple comes to him. I mean, this time it's a disciple. The other one wants to follow Jesus. Now, this one's a disciple. Let the dead bury the dead. So, the other one, this man's already a disciple, so I don't believe at all that he's not teaching us that, if you look at the whole Bible, it's not teaching that we shouldn't be involved with a funeral service for a parent or anybody else. But I think this is a hard teaching, and it's purposely a hard teaching. And it continues on that, you know, I think part of it is starting something and not finishing. You know, I'm a disciple, but, you know, again, Jesus sees the hearts of individuals. You know, the next part that you see in the parallel passage says, you know, put your hand to the plow and looking back, you know, not look back. So that's starting something, starting a tower, not finishing. A common failure of characters allow the crowding out of things that really matter by things that do not matter as much. But I see this as a challenging thing to apply. You know, some things, okay, you know, I might understand it, but, you know, okay, I got to do this, you know. And it can apply to us in everything. Work. You know, we're supposed to work, you know, to provide for our family, whatever. But, you know, there's times when you have to sit and think about that, you know, is what I'm doing, do I need to, you know, there might something start coming up where I shouldn't be doing this. You know, I might have to get a different job. I could get so involved in my work that is necessary to start crowding out all the spiritual things. You know, so it's not necessarily something that's wrong in itself. It might be something very necessary that we need to do, but we can allow it to crowd out the things that are most important. Does that make any sense? And I'll tell you, I mean, it's kind of something I'm really right in the middle of right now. You know, I'm sitting here, let the dead bury the dead, and I'm thinking, you know, there's a lot of things that I'm having to crowd out, you know, try to adjust myself. So you have to make decisions, you know, and some very hard decisions about what I can do, what I can't do, and continue on. It's just like the parable of sower, though, who receives thorn among the thorns, who hears the word and the cares of the world and the deceitfulness of riches choke the word and becomes unfruitful. So that's really, I believe, the lesson that we need to get from it is just not let the cares of the world choke us out. Go ahead.
case here, in this particular one, this is a scribe that's unnamed, but I've always wondered how many of these instances here in these first few passages after the Sermon on the Mount are directed at the soon-to-be-called apostles, because they haven't been called to this point. Peter, when he went into Peter's house and healed the mother-in-law, Peter hadn't been called an apostle. And we know that because of Luke 4 and 5, when Peter's called after that happens in that parallel passage. But I just, it's really interesting to me how many of these hard things might be directly to those men who were going to be apostles.
You know, the very next comment I had in my notes, Jesus knows the heart of men, and here he tests these men to see if they're fit for the special service he has for them. And I think, I agree with you. I think, you know, we had a sermon a couple of years, some time ago about Peter being sifted, I think was the word there used. And, you know, even after they were apostles, there was still this preparing them. Okay.
Also falls into where he tells them, those that are faithful in a few things will be faithful in the big things.
Okay.
If that has anything to do with it.
Okay. You're doing 40 now. In other words, nobody else is coming in. So. All right, you're doing or not, but we already had a lesson about the tempted to raise. So I guess we already kind of covered that, but just one comment I guess about the next section is when the storm comes and they're on the boat, and Jesus says, "Why are you fearful, O you of little faith?" So there's a storm and all this going on, and what is Jesus concerned about? What about your faith? They should have had faith. Jesus said, "We're going to the other side." They would just listen to what he said. But and also, knowing that he's the Son of God, and again, he's on a mission, this time hasn't come yet. So, you know, I think that's why he says, you know, do a little play. Because it's like, you should know we're going to make it across here. Okay, I went past. Thank y'all for your time.